Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Dow Industrials closed down today at almost 10,500. Respectable, given all that's happened in the past 12 months. But how have we done in the markets and otherwise over the past 10 years? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is New Year's Eve 2009. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. There are, generally speaking, two big ways to approach an economic story. One is to go purely by the numbers. And on that score, maybe we're really not doing much better now than we were at the end of the 1990s. Almost three times as many Americans are unemployed now as then. The number of single-family homes sold this year is 34% below the number sold in 1999. The Dow, as I mentioned, closed at almost 10,500 this afternoon. On this day in 1999, the blue chips were 1,000 points higher. But the other way to do business news is to talk about how people are feeling about the economy. And there, maybe we're not doing so badly. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Americans might feel like they've just been running in place, but most are wealthier than 10 years ago. We've had two booms and a big bust, but let's not forget the stock market's current level was widely considered to be overheated at the end of the 1990s. The way Boston College economics professor Harold Peterson sees it, the economy has spent the last decade just catching up.
What we've lost is illusion that we get in a boom. In one sense, yes, we've lost a lot, but it was money we never had, really.
Peterson concedes millions have lost their homes, jobs, and even prospects for retirement, but he says we've also gained a valuable lesson that we need to save.
People began to believe they didn't need to save for retirement. The rise in their 401ks would take care of them. The rise in their home values would take care of them. So their savings rate plummeted virtually to zero. In other words, their expectations for retirement were based upon an illusion.
That's not the only knowledge gained. Charles Geist is an economics historian at Manhattan College.
I think most people are now, even those who aren't well attuned to financial developments, I think are starting to understand that the deregulation, which was so ballyhooed in the late 1990s, was probably not a good idea.
Geist warns that without serious regulatory reform, there's a real threat the lost decade could be the one yet to come. But Boston College economist Harold Peterson believes the last decade could also have set the stage for better times. We're producing more per hour worked, and Peterson says that's bound to bring higher profits and better wages.
Wages rise more rapidly. We're more easily able to take care of Social Security and Medicare because the payroll tax brings in more. Profits rise. We'll do better with our 401ks and our pension plan. So productivity growth is the key to our future economic prosperity.
And here's to a prosperous new year. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
One other big way the economy now is different than the economy 10 years ago is that we owe way more money, on the order of trillions of dollars. To pay its bills, bailouts, and military and otherwise, the government's selling more and more IOUs. This year, the Treasury Department sold just over $2 trillion worth of debt. Bess's guesses are they're going to have to sell even more in 2010. With interest rates down near zero, it was cheap for Uncle Sam to borrow all that money this year, and there were willing buyers, too. Next year, though, maybe a different story, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Chinese are still our main creditors, but more and more Americans bought U.S. Treasuries in 2009. That's because investors were worried about the shaky economy. Quincy Crosby is a market strategist with Prudential Financial.
People were terrified. They raced out of stocks, and they just went into what they perceived as the safest part of the market, which was Treasuries.
The U.S. economy has been showing signs of recovery. The stock market is up. Stocks are more appealing. So will Treasuries still be so popular? Crosby says only if the U.S. government pays higher interest rates on its IOUs. She thinks it'll cost more for the government to borrow money next year.
Investors are just going to demand a bit more for their money. So it's investors saying, I'm not going to buy unless those rates move up.
But some economists think investors are still a bit spooked, so the government might have another year of cheap borrowing. Peter Kennan is an economist at Princeton.
I think that there will be a continued fairly strong demand for treasuries by institutional investors and even by individuals until people are very much more confident that this economy is on solid ground and growing steadily.
Kennan says that applies to American and foreign investors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's always a flurry of financial activity this time of year, most of it geared around the tax code. A lot of people sell stocks or mutual funds to minimize their bills come April the 15th. And those of us with balances left in our flexible spending accounts have to use it or lose it. A lot of companies offer FSAs. They let you sock away money tax-free to pay for healthcare expenses. But an awful lot of people find themselves with money left over this time of year, including our very own Amy Scott, who reports now on the big business of the end-of-year FSA rush.
I found Randy Morgan perusing aviator sunglasses at LensCrafters this afternoon. He was looking for a way to use up the last $250 in his flexible spending account.
Actually, I had almost $800 left over up till yesterday, but then I started purchasing some over-the-counter things that I know I'll be needing.
No judgment here. I overestimated my out-of-pocket expenses this year and wound up buying a pair of last-minute prescription shades myself rather than lose the money. Unused cash goes back to your employer, by the way, but they have to spend it on benefits. Anyway, LensCrafters says people like me and Randy Morgan make up a significant chunk of their business this time of year. Seth Scarberg is general manager at my local branch.
And we're making it easy for customers to use those flex spending dollars with our current promotions of 30% off a complete pair. We've got a great prescription sun offer for them.
But is this really a good way to make healthcare decisions? Critics of the use-it-or-lose-it system say it leads to wasteful spending. John Hickman is with the Employers' Council on Flexible Compensation. The group's members administer flexible spending programs. He says the vast majority of people use up their funds well before the end of the year.
Most people use up the flexible spending account election on things like deductibles and coinsurance and copayments.
Not on $100 worth of Tylenol on New Year's Eve. But soon people might find it harder to use up their unclaimed FSA funds. The House version of the health care reform bill won't allow spending on over-the-counter drugs. The Senate version requires a doctor's note. Both bills reduce the maximum amount you can save from an average $4,500 to $2,500. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the major indices ran out of gas as the year did. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, honestly, not all that much happened in the economy this week that's worth spending the next 4 minutes on, but it has been a heck of a year, and 2010 may yet turn out to be trickier than we think. So that said, here are Felix Salmon from Reuters, John Carney, also from ClusterStock, and our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Gentlemen, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Glad to be here.
So the questions this week, I think, are going to be fairly simple, yet requiring some thought. Felix, I guess we'll start with you. Question number one on this New Year's Eve is, are we better off now than we were 12 months ago?
I think we are better off, if only because we're moving in a positive rather than incredibly negative direction. This time last year, we were sinking fast, and we had no idea whether the world was coming to an end or not.
John, what do you think?
Well, I agree partly with Felix, but I think a lot of Americans all across the country would feel that they're a lot worse off. Unemployment is much higher than it was a year ago. The only thing we can say is that it doesn't look like we're heading off the cliff the way it did a year ago. But for a lot of Americans, they feel like they've already fallen off the cliff and they're at the bottom of the canyon.
So what do we need to do, John, to make sure that 2010 doesn't lead us off that cliff again?
Well, hopefully we've already done it. 2010 is going to be the year of the test. If 2009 was the year of the rescue, 2008 was the year of the collapse, 2010 is going to be the test of whether the rescue really worked. Or was it just a temporary patch that made the banks boom for a year and the rest of the economy is still going to sink?
So, Felix, that's a fairly elaborate theory from Mr. Carney there, the collapse and rescue and test thing. What do you think?
I kind of agree with John, actually, bizarrely, on this one. I think that the 2010 is going to be the year that we find out whether the real economy can recover, because it's quite easy to fix the financial economy. You just create an infinite amount of free money and give infinite amounts of free money to the banks, and they start making money again and they're happy. And that solved the panic problem. But what we haven't solved, as John says, is the unemployment problem, the demand problem, the fact that the entire planet is suffering from the fact that there's no big U.S. consumer-led demand to bring all of these economies, which have suffered greatly, back to the levels that we had got used to.
All right, but if we know about the lack of a U.S. consumer-led recovery, and if we know about unemployment in this country's problems, what don't we know about, Felix? And I realize this is kind of a meta question, but what don't we know about that's going to bite us in the fanny next year?
What we don't know about is who's going to default. People tend to panic quite a lot when there's a major default on bonds or loans. And although a lot of people are expecting a wave of commercial real estate defaults, mm-hmm. we don't know which big companies are going to default. We don't know if any big sovereigns are going to default, or even little sovereigns for that matter. And the debt market, I think, is going to throw up a couple of surprises. We just don't know where they're going to be.
All right, John, what's your nomination for what we don't know yet that's really going to hurt us?
Well, the thing that could really surprise us to hurt us is if China's economy turns out and is revealed to be not as strong as it seems. A lot of hedge funds are betting either way on this, that the Chinese economy may be, you know, just as strong and keep growing the way it's been growing, or it may all have turned out to be a mirage. And we'll find out that China turns into the biggest accounting scandal the world has ever seen. And that collapse of the Chinese economy will affect the entire world.
Boy, wouldn't that be something, huh?
That'll be quite the worldwide event.
That's right.
But I actually think there's a possible upside surprise to this year as well.
All right.
I think it's possible that in the panic of late 2008 and early 2009 and all through this year, businesses laid off a lot of people. If the economy turns out to actually be recovering, they may have laid off too many people, and so we may actually get a surprise hiring, an end to the mass joblessness that we've seen. And so it could turn out that the overshoot on the downside ends up boosting 2010 bigger than anybody expected.
Well, here's to hope. And John Carney from ClusterStock.com and Felix Salmon from Reuters, Happy New Year's, guys.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Kay.
Every Friday, our Morning Report host Bill Radke squeezes all the week's business news into a 60-second poem. We call it, cleverly enough, the Marketplace Minute. But for this New Year's Eve, ending the decade, we have challenged him to go one better. Condense not just a year's worth of economic events, but a whole decade, all 10 years, into that same minute.
The problem began on New Year's Day, the year 2000, Y2K. We thought the computer response would be rocky, and then when it wasn't, I think we got cocky. So when the dot-commers ran into their troubles, well, we weren't afraid of the danger of bubbles. We told ourselves the ensuing recession was all about terrorists and their aggression. Interest rates falling to practically zero. Greenspan's a genius, a national hero. Enron and WorldCom were cooking their books, but U.S. executives mostly aren't crooks. This is a country where companies fail, but capitalism will always prevail. It brought us the Kindle and PlayStation 3 and YouTube and Gmail and Wiki and Wii, iPods, iTunes, iPhones. I thought I should buy Apple stock. I, of course, did not. Instead, I own Chrysler and GMAC and Fannie and Freddie, GM, AIG. And how could our leaders have not seen this coming? Why'd we assume that our system was humming? The start of the decade set off this reaction. It lulled the U.S. into self-satisfaction. I'm telling you, life would be better today if the world had just ended on Y2K.
Bill Radke, he hosts our morning show. You can watch the Marketplace Minute video that Bill does every week on our website. It's marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
Coming up, college bowl games and a little bit of controversy.
If Congress wants to change the name of the BCS because it's not decided on a playoff, maybe shouldn't they also change the name of the World Series because Italy and Japan and Australia are not included?
Well, no, I don't think so, but we'll let you hear that story. But first, though, let's do the numbers. 2009, the year that was. The Dow Industrials plunged 120 points today. That is 1 1/10%. Closed at 10,428. The NASDAQ lost 22 points, nearly 1%, closed at 2269. The S&P 500 shaved off 11 points, 1%, to finish at 1115. Forget the week that was. We're going to do the year that was. The Dow was up 18.8% for the past 12 months. NASDAQ up 43.8%. The S&P 500 up 23.5%. 23.5%, I guess, is another way to say that. Despite rumors today that it might be releasing a tablet computer next month, Apple peeled off a loss of more than 0.33% today. Shareholders of Marvel Entertainment proved its acquisition by Disney, but even Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk couldn't lift the two stocks. Marvel closed up just a few hundredths of 1%. Disney was down by about the same slim margin. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at SaveAndInvest.org. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Markets are closed. The world takes a breather on New Year's Day. The 121st Tournament of Roses Parade floats through Pasadena. And have you resolved to clear out the clutter next year? January is Get Organized Month. The National Association of Professional Organizers offers tips at public events to create order. I've marked one of my calendars somewhere. Where did I put 2010? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't know if you remember this, but back in February and March, before the healthcare fight really got going, financial reform was the hot topic in Washington. The Dow was down at 6,000-something, and the near collapse of the banking system was still fresh in pretty much everybody's mind. That is obviously not the case now, but a reform bill is slowly making its way through Congress. To talk with us about the prospects for financial reform, or perhaps the lack thereof, we've got our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale on the line. Hi, John.
Hello, Kai.
This crisis has given us, and this is kind of a strong word, but it's given us an opportunity to reshape the rules for the financial industry. Have we done that?
Not yet, but not for want of trying. We've been through hours and hours of hearings, reams of testimony. There were hundreds of proposals. Remember, even before the crisis hit full force, the Bush administration was proposing a comprehensive restructuring of the system. That was back in March of 2008. And then President Obama's team sent Congress its ideas. The House got to work first, thanks to some stubborn persistence by Finance Committee Chairman Barney Frank. And after six separate committees drafted parts of a bill that ultimately runs 1,280 pages, it passed the House earlier this month.
And what did we, the taxpayers, get for all that effort?
Well, it's a bill that is comprehensive, with a little something for everyone. It provides for unwinding banks that are too big to fail. It requires banks to set aside more money to cover when their investments go bad. It sets up a consumer protection agency, regulates derivatives, tries to reduce those conflicts of interest for credit rating agencies that continue to give AAA ratings to those toxic investments. But to find out whether those reforms are on the right track, I checked with Joseph Grunfest. He's a former SEC commissioner, now a professor at Stanford.
I'm afraid that I would give Congress and the government an F-, and that's only because I'm an easy grader.
Grunfest says that all the reforms are missing a fundamental flaw in the regulatory structure, that the government remains the insurer of last resort in the financial system, and that's encouraging risky behavior by lenders and investors.
And if the government's going to be in the insurance business, it has to act like a rational insurer. If you're a more dangerous driver, you pay more for your insurance. If you are a financial institution and you engage in riskier behavior, you should also be required to pay more.
Now, Grunfest says none of the reforms so far changed these insurance subsidies to the financial industry, which means taxpayers could still end up bailing the system out.
Yeah, which brings us to the $64,000 question, right, John, which is how do you get the government out of this thing they've gotten themselves into of being the insurer of last resort?
Congress is pulled in so many different directions by powerful interests that have negotiated subsidies for worthy-sounding goals. You know, tax breaks for mortgages, for example, are a huge subsidy for the housing industry, or favorable home loans, small business loans in hurricane-prone areas or earthquake zones. Grunfest says that those subsidies allow industries to take risks and tap taxpayers when the things go bad.
So you mentioned the House earlier, John. We're going out of the Senate. Chris Dodd has a bill that's going on there. Is anything substantive going to happen in 2010, or are we going to be back in healthcare land again?
Well, I think that there will be something after health reform is dealt with. Financial regulatory reform is next on the agenda. Senator Dodd's bill is criticized for too much government intrusion in private markets. It consolidates the four bank regulators into one. So it's unclear whether the bill has enough support to get out of committee, much less the floor, and then the House and Senate have to resolve their differences. So there's been a lot of wheel spinning, not a whole lot of traction, but I think that might be because healthcare kind of made the road a little slippery.
All right. Well, we'll see. I guess it'll be an interesting year. John Dimsdale in Washington for us. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Guy.
Remember back when college football bowl season meant just a handful of games, all or most of them anyway, on New Year's Day? Things are a little bit different nowadays. We are not quite halfway through all of this year's bowls, even though 14 of them have already been played. 19 to go, including 5 in the Bowl Championship Series, BCS for short. They are the big money games. Lots of cash, also lots of controversy, as Nancy Fargali explains.
First thing you need to know about being a Rose Bowl volunteer, wear comfy shoes. You'll be walking the stairs of Rose Bowl Stadium in Pasadena a lot. Your job? Making sure every ticket has a corresponding seat.
A is here through 16? Okay. B, 1 through 16?
The stadium will not only have its namesake Rose Bowl game tomorrow, the BCS National Championship game will be here too next Thursday. Mitch Dorger is the CEO of the Pasadena Tournament of Roses. The organization is hosting both events.
We believe the total impact on the greater LA area is going to be between $350 and $400 million for the both games. That's as good as it gets for us.
But the BCS isn't rosy for everyone. Some consider it downright thorny. It's an exclusive club of 6 college athletic conferences. They get an automatic bid to a BCS bowl and a guaranteed payout of $18 million in TV revenue and ticket sales. It's not a traditional playoff system like what you see in college basketball. Instead, the BCS relies on a computer ranking system. Paul Swangard teaches sports marketing at the University of Oregon.
The BCS, which is probably more confusing than a lot of the introductory math classes here at the University of Oregon are taught, gives us 2 teams at the end of the session of the regular season that will play in ultimately this last bowl game for the national championship.
The system has been a magnet for controversy, but member conferences don't seem to be in much of a hurry to come up with an alternative. In the last 4 years, they've taken in nearly $500 million at bowl time. That's compared to just $62 million for conferences that aren't members. Swangard says the BCS has created a system of have and have-nots.
It's those on the outside of the pot of gold want to see if they can reach a hand in on a more regular basis.
Meantime, some lawmakers in Congress are working on legislation to force the BCS to drop all references to a national championship. It's an effort to get the group to include more conferences and eventually switch to a traditional playoff system. Bill Hancock is the executive director for the BCS.
If Congress wants to change the name of the BCS because it's not decided on a playoff, maybe shouldn't they also change the name of the World Series because Italy and Japan and Australia are not included?
One thing's for sure. There will be at least two undefeated teams at the end of this bowl season, and they won't face each other. That's enough to keep the BCS in the news through the off season. I'm Nancy Fregali for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the last of 2009. So what better day to look back? Not at all the big stories we've covered, but at the best of the funner stuff, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
What story are you going to be talking about at your dinner party this weekend?
Charles Dickens' toothpick has just sold at auction in New York for $9,150.
The 2009 Toy Fair unveiled the Bernie Madoff doll. It's called the Smash Me Bernie doll. It comes with a golden hammer, and you can actually smash the doll.
Well, I like the story about Whole Foods staff having this training program for shoppers so they can teach you how to shop cheaply.
So I guess the first tip they'd give is to leave Whole Foods immediately.
I'm going to give you a California story. It is from San Joaquin County. The sheriff's department has bought a vehicle that weighs so much that it's illegal in California to drive.
So somewhere in San Joaquin County, this vehicle is just driving in circles, trying to catch itself to give itself a ticket.
Well, there's a Japanese invention. They're producing suits that are coated with a chemical usually found in toothpaste that will protect you against swine flu.
See, I've got a simpler swine flu suit. It's a neon lime green, and whenever I wear it, people just stay far away from me.
A university in Liverpool is now offering a master's degree in Beatles music.
What?
And now I'm starting to rethink the master's degree that I actually did.
You worked 8 days a week for what?
Exactly.
Well, now I know how to follow up my Metallica GED.
You know the Snuggie, the blanket with sleeves that people are wearing? They make it for dogs now.
You are kidding me.
No. Check it out.
Now there's Snuggie Dog, the little blanket with sleeves designed to fit your dog.
Stop it. It's too much.
The podcast that Rico and Brendan put together is called The Dinner Party Download. You can find a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace this Thursday afternoon, the end of 2009 from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 120 points. That's 1.1%. The NASDAQ off 22 points, 1%. The S&P 500 nicked off 9 points, 0.8%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, the upside to losing your job.
Gosh, it's a great feeling. It is like being on vacation some days. Like, what do I want to do today? Now I have flexibility.
And then the unemployment checks stop. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.